Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Richard Campanella about his book, Crossroads, Cutoffs, and Confluences, Origins of Louisiana Cities, Towns, and Villages. This is the first of a two-part conversation. Always a treat to have a new book from Richard Campanella, and his newest, Crossroads, Cutoffs, and Confluences, Origins of Louisiana Cities, Towns, and Villages, is a real treat. Rich is a professor of geography at Tulane University and dean for research at the Tulane School of Architecture. He has received the Louisiana Writer Award from the State Center for the Book at the State Library and has been named a Knight of the Order of the Academic Palms by the French government. Oh, I love saying that. His many, many books include Bourbon Street, A History, Bienville's Dilemma, Draining New Orleans, and Nocturnal New Orleans with photographer Marco Rossi, just to name a few. So, Rich, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much.
It's such a treat.
Wonderful to be here, truly.
Oh, my gosh. This is a book that sets out to answer that age-old question, why are we here, literally? And I'm sure you packed on the miles for doing this project.
I did indeed, by the thousands. Multiple trips all through the state, every corner, all 64 parishes, and all on winding roads and back roads, and it was absolutely wonderful.
I noticed you dedicate this book to your wife and son and thank them for their interest inciting stories?
So yeah,
You weren't by yourself.
In fact, we did one trip together. Doing research trips with your family can be a little tenuous sometimes, but we had a wonderful one in January of 2024. It was crisp, perfect Louisiana weather. Chilly, clear blue skies, good for photography. And we covered all through the Acadian region and, you know, going along these phenomena that gave rise to these places. Mm-hmm. And many of them were confluences and forks and bayous and ridges. So it was wonderful.
I bet you got a lot of good food that day, too.
Yes.
That weekend.
The best stuff is on the local supermarkets.
So tell us.
It's a little deli section in local
supermarkets. You can bring a lot back, too. That's the other fun part. So tell us some of the reasons for founding a place, would you?
Well, there's probably about 20 or 30 of them, and they repeat worldwide. And I'll just rattle off some. Three of them are right in the title. Crossroads, where terrestrial arteries come together, where rivers bifurcate or fork, where they come together, where they conflow. Cutoffs, meaning shortcuts. Heads of navigation, as far up a river or a bayou or stream you could get with the vessels of the day, at which point you have to disembark. Points of proximity, I call them perigee points, where one realm comes closest to another. Ferries, bridges, wherever humanity slows down, funnels, stops for the night, or needs resources at certain periodicities. This has been observed. In the book, I use the term 5 mile and 10 mile towns. Mm-hmm. There's also the phenomenon where if you have a perfectly flat surface, towns will arise in kind of a grid-like pattern because people have certain needs. If whether you're coming in a steamboat or a flatboat or in an automobile, you're going to need to stop for fuel, for lodging at certain distances. So if two cities are too far apart, something is probably going to emerge in the middle. And then you have administrative sites, be they parish courthouses or national capitals. So it's a series of geographical advantages as well as human needs that explain why we live where we live.
You quote a geographer. I wonder if you feel like you're part of a big fraternity of geographers sometimes.
Except they're all dead.
I know. That's the other thing. But he says that the geographer's first duty is to render site and situation.
Right.
And you say that New Orleans is a lousy site, but a great situation.
Yeah, and those are the most Shakespearean dramas in this story, when you have that tension between a city that has to exist. You have this great river draining so much of the continent. How could there not be a city at or near its mouth, except that the local geography offers no perfect site and not even close? So you have this tension between, I call it the least dirty shirt in the laundry, the least lousy site that Bienville selected in an absolutely fantastic geographical situation at the mouth of what proved to be the wealthiest valley on earth. That's the tension that runs through this book. As humans endeavor to find an optimal site, even though it might not be great, to take advantage of a strategic geographical situation.
And you talk about the difference between emergent places, which emerge from the bottom up.
Correct.
And ordained sites,
correct.
Top down.
Right. And those are my coinages, and they really needed to be coined, because as I went through the about 500 cities, towns, and villages throughout Louisiana and elsewhere, you realize that some of them are spontaneous based on human spatial movements toward the desire for better lives, versus an empowered individual saying, we're going to put a train station here. We are going to put a parish seat here from the top down. And humanity agglomerates around it. And sometimes you see a little bit of both. So sometimes there might be an emergent site that happens spontaneously, but then a railroad station opens a mile away and they get nudged over. And sure, you see this along the River Road versus Airline Highway versus I-10. Oh. Airline Highway replaced the River Road. And sure enough, Laplace and places like that started to regroup along Airline. Then I-10 comes along, and now you have these gas station communities along I-10. So they get nudged.
And one of the interesting things that you write is that the settlers were aided in some ways by having seen how Native Americans lived on this landscape.
Very much so. The geographer I quote, Newton, points out that when Europeans arrived here, they encountered a landscape that had been humanized. And at the top of that list of humanization was settlement sites. And so the trails were in place. They might have been game trails. They might have been native trails chasing the game. But they pointed to these fords, these low spots, these portage sites, these shortcuts. So the map had almost been laid out for them.
It's incredible. So you give us 15 geographical regions and 418 towns, villages, and cities. It's amazing.
It's a loose count. They're hard to count. Some of them I delve into quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Others I lump together as all being in a... And so it's about 500 or so. I'm a believer in when you devise regions and you draw lines on maps, to be soft and fuzzy about it.
Sure.
I'm not a believer in artificial hard. If you cross this line, then no, that's a whole different region. It's nonsense. It's not the way the world works. And so I devise them lumping together parishes with their underlying geographical phenomena. And, you know, there's an arbitrary element to it.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Richard Campanella about his new book, Crossroads, Cutoffs, and Confluences, Origins of Louisiana Cities, Towns, and Villages. Now, one of the things I think is so interesting is that you say, well, lest we think geography is not destiny, which we know it is. I mean, but you talk about Alexandria, Brobridge, and Cutoff, for example, and you say that every day people who live there reckon with decisions that were made at the founding of those towns.
Every moment of our lives.
I know.
Of our spatial lives, that is the movements that you and I made to get to the studio today, can be spatially traceable back to those original sighting stories, even if we don't even know about them anymore.
Yeah.
That blows me away. And it made me realize that all the contingencies, all the things that had to happen, that's where the original idea for this book came from. I had just finished Draining New Orleans, which really gets you into the mud in New Orleans, figuratively, literally.
Which was literally a
page-turner. Well, thank you very much. But it was tough engineering research to do. And it was really, really in the mud. So I wanted to kind of stretch my legs after that and wanted to do something statewide. And I've never really worked statewide before, right. At least not at the book level. And one night in July of 22, you know, you wake up at 3 a.m. and you have this clarity of vision.
Yeah.
You know, of all the geographical inquiries that I do, which is the one question that I truly love, the one that really fascinates me most? And it was this one. And I coined the term sighting stories. And that is to say, what were the original reasons why this city formed here? Why humans agglomerated in the site. Mm-hmm. And so what I decided 3 a.m. that morning was that instead of my usual approach, which is to delve deeply in geographical questions of New Orleans, let me flip it. Let me focus on one geographical inquiry, that sighting story inquiry, and apply it broadly across hundreds of places. Mm-hmm. And that's what the idea for this book.
So were you traveling in landscapes that were new to you when you were doing like North Louisiana, say, or...
There were many spots I had not visited before. There were many others I have not visited in decades, since most of my research has been New Orleans focused over the past 20 or so years. So I started it by exploring hundreds and hundreds of miles day after day, collecting raw data, old maps, visiting parish courthouses. Parish libraries was so important. Mm-hmm. They have that sacred local interest room. You know what I'm talking
always.
About? Where all the genealogy stuff is. And they have many times these unpublished parish history and manuscripts written by people 100 years ago who were children when these places were coming together. And those are really valuable. And so I'm driving on back roads, long bayous, 14-hour days, absolutely wonderful, day after day after day. And I come home with all this information, all this research materials, and I have a cramp in my leg. And I'm thinking, well, that's, you know, it's all that driving. So I walk it off in Audubon Park. Next day, it's worse.
Oh, no.
Cramps get better. Blood clots get worse. The next day I was in the hospital.
Okay,
so that's how this project began.
Oh my God.
I'm still wearing the compression sock.
I see that.
You know, blood clots can be really dangerous really quickly. But anyway, that's what one little unexpected.
Well, you are indispensable, so you better be taking care of yourself. Oh. Well, you talk a lot about the institutions that a town or city or village really needs to have, you know, courthouse.
That's right.
Church.
So post office.
Post office. That was urgent.
These are magnets, okay? Mm-hmm. There's such a phenomenon as a Sunday town.
Particularly
in the Acadian country, that, you know, Catholic Mass and Sunday Mass had such religious and social import that people gravitated to them every Sunday. Sometimes you'd leave on Saturday. And so it had a spillover effect. Mm-hmm. And it might gain some other houses, a store. And then once a school and a post office come, you have more of a gravitational force. So most of the sighting stories are, you know, quite you could really see how a village would come out of it. There are some other cases where there are elements of happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is in Reserve, Louisiana, that it was really a real estate trend, the happenstance of a particular real estate transaction that gave rise to the sugar processing facility that was there, mm-hmm. and gives us the community today. We have a couple of others where the sighting story is still, in other words, the original rationale for its development is still prominent and visible and dominant in the landscape. One of them is Gramercy, where you could see the huge sugar refining plant. And the other is Bogalusa, which was an ordained town, if ever there was one, for timber purposes. Mm-hmm. And today, the paper mill is the derivative of that and still dominates the skyline.
Well, talk about how Gramercy got its name, which was such a transplanted,
exactly.
Now.
It's in the least Louisiana, least Cajun way imaginable.
Yes.
You think Gramercy today, and you think, oh, the bonfires, it must have some Gramercy Park in Manhattan, okay? The ultimate transplant.
I mean.
A name for the financiers behind the timber industry there. And like Lotcher, that these were resource extraction sites. And that's a big story here. Sulfur, salt, timber. Many of our northern and western Louisiana communities started as resource extraction.
I was also fascinated to see how Araby got its name.
Yes. Payush Arabi, a hero in Egypt, because he, like Sampit Menard Parrish, fought the English. Very different times and circumstances, but he was kind of in the news at the time, and they used him to name the town.
But there was a contest.
Yes, yes.
It's right. Like, name a town. I love that. It's just, the other thing you do, this harkens back to, you know, fifth grade geography, is talk about how industry has transformed landscape, and especially here, as we know, the petrochemical industry. So talk about some of those discoveries.
Yeah. Most people know that the oil industry in Louisiana dates to the 1901 strike in Jennings and just before that in Beaumont. It's all within a couple mm-hmm. of months. But in fact, there was exploration. People knew about oil. It was coming out of the ground back to the 1850s in Lake Charles. That's how sulfur, sulfur outside of Lake Charles, which is this crystalline brimstone that is associated. And so there was, this industry was bubbling up even before it blew. And then once by the early 1900s, it utterly transformed. And it transforms the not necessarily new formation of new towns, but it repurposes old towns. Mm-hmm. Two examples are the Thibodaux-Houma area and Lafayette, which started out, Lafayette is a head of navigation site. It was the head of navigation on the Vermilion River, hence Vermilion. Millionville, when the Garden District used to be Lafayette and got incorporated into New Orleans, Lafayette was open for a name. And so Vermilionville took the name mm-hmm. and becomes Lafayette. It repurposed itself for the petrochemical industry. Thibodaux-Houma, these start as fork and confluence sites on a network of ridges. They repurpose themselves for oil field services.
Amazing. And then we have, you know, sugar, timber. Timber really figures into this.
Timber and railroads work in unison. This is in the mostly post-Civil War, and they account, by the last chapter does what's never been done before, kind of this empirical analysis of emergent and all these, you know, actual numbers. And there are more railroad sites, okay, sites originating from the placement of a station than any other. However, because most of them were timber towns, the timber has since run out, and these are tiny little dots on the map. It's only in their sheer quantity that they rise to the top. If you look at where people live, it is still those old riverine siding stories that explain why most of us in Louisiana live where we live.
Riverine is one of my favorite words. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Richard Campanella about his new book, Crossroads, Cutoffs, and Confluences: Origins of Louisiana Cities, Towns, and Villages. Now, one site that really required special aspects was Carville.
Yes, one of a kind, a very moving story. This is the, as people called it back then, the leper colony.
Right.
Now, Carville did pre-exist, and it's got roots to James Carville's family. He was a shopkeeper, and I think he came down to teach after the Civil War, his great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And so it did pre-exist, but it really got, it came into becoming a community when Hampson's disease, when it was selected in the grim reality of quarantine. And one of its attributes was that it was both isolated from major population centers and yet accessible to them. You could float the victims of this disease at night along the river. You could railroad them in, and Carville was well emplaced for that. And I would strongly encourage anyone listening to us today to go visit the museum there. It is a deeply moving experience.
Really, it is. And the cemetery, too.
Yeah.
It's just an incredible place. But how many times do you run into quarantine as a geographical concern,
That's
you know?
Right.
Also, the Asian settlements, which I find so interesting.
Yeah, also one of a kind in that they built their own landscape.
Yeah.
These are up on pilings. They're Manila Village. Some were Chinese, some were ethnic Filipinos. And it's a quintessential example of a resource extraction site. You go where the shrimp are.
Yeah.
The shrimp are going to be out in these saline marshes. There's no land there. You build your own land on wooden pilings, and they were so elaborate they had their own residential, like they lived on them, and they actually grew crops on them. There were these expansive flower pots, and they grew gardens on them, even as they caught the shrimp, laid them out, dried them, and then by wrapping their feet in burlap would do these dances on them. To separate the spiky head from the dried meat, they would salt them and then sell them in Chinatown here in New Orleans.
Wow. I love that you can go to New Orleans East, to Vietnam, and the Vietnamese community there and see that landscape.
It's so otherworldly. It is a cultural landscape directly extracted. Their gardens are right out of the Mekong Delta.
Now, there's another landscape you refer to as otherworldly, and that's Port Fouchon.
Port Fouchon comes out of the loop, the Louisiana offshore project, which originally was positioned for the mouth of the Mississippi River, but found a better emplacement there. And I refer to it in the book as arguably Louisiana's last sighting story. Now, it's not a village, right? But it is a humanized community. They built their own landscape. Hundreds upon hundreds of people work there in and out every day. It's on the map. But that was 1981, and of all the histograms and things that I computed, that's one of the probably the last major place name on the map. I would mention that there's also this phenomena of the so-called breakaway city. Central Louisiana is one. The most recent example is St. George, and we won't go into the politics, but these are cities that already exist as human communities that break away, form their own municipal identity, usually for reasons involving school districts.
Mm-hmm, of course. One of the things that's so great about this book is that you just drop these little bombs. You're like reading along and it's like, oh, okay. And this is like a first. This is like the only. It's so interesting. And one of them is the story of New Roads, which is one of the few places founded by a woman or a person of color.
A woman of color. That's right. New Roads is one of a series of sites that people might be surprised all have the same sighting story. Opelousas, Marksville, New Roads, Monroe. Okay. Mm-hmm. And their commonality was, if you think of Spanish Louisiana, the last three decades of the 18th century, the Spanish are trying to, they have a policy called poblando la barrera, populating the barrier. They took Louisiana colony as a buffer zone between their true prize to the west, Mexico and the rest of it, and their enemy to the east, the British. And so New Roads, Opelousas, Marksville, and Monroe are just up on these terraces, and they establish militarized sites. They are garrisons. In the case of New Roads, of course, you have False River, okay? So when you come up the river, a False River being that oxbow that broke away from the Mississippi in 1722, and so it's a good jumping off point into that western frontier.
Yeah.
And so there was un camino nuevo, a new road cut from the river to this False River, and where the two men, this particular woman, a free woman of color who owned the land there, had the foresight to realize the value that transportation brings to real estate. And that new road triggered her to subdivide that area. And that is today's New Roads, Louisiana.
Amazing. Another thing you talk about the sighting of Angola.
Yes. It's similar in a strange way to that of the leper colony at Carville, in that it was well positioned, being on the river and roughly centrally located, but it was also part of that system in which convicts were leased out for levee building and plantation labor. To this day, it's the largest human community in West Feliciana Parish.
Wow.
Even though we don't think of it as
staggering.
Yeah.
And you drop the phrase geography of incarceration, all of a sudden your mind tends toward that direction.
Yeah. If you look at a map at the county level of populations, of male versus female populations, of the whole nation, you'll see these single counties that are evenly distributed that are predominantly male. 9 times out of 10, that's a state penitentiary.
Wow. And there's even one town, this I was quite struck by, that was owned by a sole owner and a sole inhabitant. and it was Manuel Gonzalez and right. Galvez Town.
Right. He was the last of them. Galvez Town is now a ghost town. It's up on Bayou Manchac as it becomes the Amite River, and that is a relic of that Spanish-British tension. Mm-hmm. And it was put there, and people started to, as a fort by Galvez, to guard against British West Florida. When the revolution broke out between American patriots and the British, English-speaking in British West Florida, who were just families who did not want to, who didn't want a part of the violence, and there was violence in Baton Rouge, yeah. They actually crossed the Bayou Manchac and settled in Spanish Galvestown, and they made peace with each other. Both British and Spanish made peace with each other and settled in Galvestown. And so what happened was that once Spain defeated British, and then, of course, the Americans defeat the British and the British are off the stage, Galvestown lost its sighting story. Wow. It didn't need to be there anymore. And the individual you referred to was the last occupant.
My guest has been Richard Campanella talking about his terrific new book, Crossroads, Cutoffs, and Confluences, Origins of Louisiana Cities, Towns, and Villages. Rich, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This has been a blast.
And thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Clavis Natera discusses and signs the Grand Paloma Resort, Tuesday, August 26th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Sandy Rosenthal discusses and signs the anniversary edition of her Katrina book, Words Whispered in Water, Wednesday, August 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kiana Walker Mlamal discusses and signs Behind the Waterline, Thursday, August 28th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.